everyone. Welcome to the latest episode of Missing Figures, stories about power, perseverance, and possibility that should be common knowledge. Today's episode is going to be about Bayard Rustin, someone that I really look up to. And I would say my descriptors for Bayard Rustin, I don't even know. Like, truthfully, I don't even know. Like, we're, I guess, LGBTQ. I'm just a huge fan, and I feel like he doesn't get a lot of credit, or his credit is downplayed a lot when it comes to the history of just civil rights. Sherry, what do you got?
Well, hi, everybody. Sherry here, Sherry Renard. I agree with Cynthia. I'm really excited about today's episode and our subject, Bayard Rustin. I don't have a descriptor that's specific to this incredible man, but really am a beneficiary of every single thing that he fought for. So I was really excited to learn more about him, because shamefully, I did not know everything there is to know. And I'm excited to talk about it with you and share it with all of you listening.
Me too. I would say with Bayard Rustin, what I really, really, really liked about him was that he was an openly gay civil rights organizer and activist, and he was really known for helping out like the group, like MLK and all the people that ran in his crew. So yes, today's episode is going to be about Bayard Rustin. And what I really, really like to talk about is just like his life in general was very interesting. He was an openly gay civil rights organizer and activist. And this is like back in the 60s, everybody. So being gay was not as open or accepting, and I'm not saying it's 100% open and accepting, but it's definitely a lot better now compared to where it was back then. And he was also just very, very out. He was an advisor to MLK or Martin Luther King Jr. He is actually a really key piece when it comes to talking about like the nonviolent resistance and protests that MLK is kind of known for when it comes to the civil rights movement that was pushing through in the 50s and 60s. So Bayard Rustin was touching a lot of different things, and he was definitely, I feel like in some ways they kind of downplayed his, I guess, his cause or his commitment to civil rights, which I find is very, to me, it's very tragic and very problematic, in my opinion.
Yes, he is not one of the first names that you think of when you think of the civil rights era. But in fact, I mean, I think we've even understated his role, because I really feel like he was the architect of this. I think every movement that actually results in something, in moving forward, there has to be the admin around it, the organizing around it, the goal setting, the strategizing around it. And this is what he brought to it. And you touched on a key point. He was raised, I mean, he was born in 1912, and he was born to a teenage mother, mm-hmm. who was a single mother and raised by his grandparents, a mother who he thought was his sister. They didn't tell him.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, but that was kind of common though. I feel like there's a lot of people that I've heard similar stories. Like, they were raised. I even actually had a friend that was similar. That what happened to her.
Yeah. Well, like you said, he was surrounded by stigma of all sorts. And I mean, you mentioned being, you know, LGBTQ, but he, as a black man, is an extra layer. And who we thought were his parents were his grandparents. But the interesting thing about them was they were Quakers. And the Quakers were for peace. They were a peaceful movement. They were part of the abolitionist movement. Their guiding, I guess, what would you call it?
Philosophy?
Philosophy, thank you for that word, was that there was a single human family, mm-hmm. And all of the members of that family were equal. And so it was so much so that when Bayard told his grandmother that he thought he liked boys, she just said, you know, I guess that's what you need to do. That's it. He's part of our human family. He's somebody I love. This is it. And I think maybe in his youth, being accepted in that way made it perfectly fine for him to be out in the world. And what you said too is I think he didn't get credit because unfortunately he understood, and I think other people in the movement, many movements actually that he supported, knew that it made them a target and it made the movement a target because of his sexuality.
Yeah.
And so he stayed in the background.
I feel like he stayed in the background. I feel like, I don't know if he, I would say he truly stayed in the background though. I would say the story painted, because he was very out there. You know, he would do speeches. He would go out. He would give interviews. So I think he was like in the scene, but I just think like the story that's told and with everything, like MLK became like the front guy or the front runner. And then he had other people that we may know about in the background, and that was it. And Bayard Rustin just happened to be one that I feel like they downplayed more because of his sexual orientation. They felt like, oh, no. Because then if he's one, then they're going to suspect all of us. But he was very popular within, like, the civil rights and his approach to everything. I would also say that with him having, like, this humanist, like, a humanist approach to things, he felt like the civil rights struggle wasn't just necessarily Black versus white. He felt like there was no way that we would be able to come together and rise as like a people until like without having people that weren't Black in the movement. So that's, and another thing that I found about him, which I didn't know, was that that's another reason why he didn't necessarily co-sign with the Black Panthers. I don't think he necessarily came out and said like, I don't like the Black Panthers, but he said he didn't necessarily believe that you can't really make viable concrete change by excluding people. Or excluding white people. Like, it's everyone's fight. So, so he was very much about, like you said, like being the humanist, being leaning on his Quaker, his faith, and everything like that. But I also think there was an issue, not just with his being him being gay, but the fact that he was also known to have communist ties. And I know back then that was like a huge thing, because like the Red Scare and everything that was happening. In the world, they were like, no. And it's true. He was part of the Communist Party or had communist ties. But this is when the Communist Party was very much about like, you know, we're trying to bring people together. We're trying to make things equal and all that other type
of
stuff.
Raise all boats.
Yeah.
Raise all boats. Yeah. That's it. You're right. But it's interesting. He stuck to his nonviolence, peace-oriented, you know, view, because the reason he broke with the Communist Party is because, you know, during World War II, they decided they were going to fight. They needed to fight. And he was against war. So that actually got him into a lot of trouble as well. He went to prison for not turning up to the draft board. And this guy, you know, anytime, so I thought it was interesting. We've had a lot of subjects that very young in life, very, very early on in their lives, they seem to hone in on what they were going to fight for or what they were going to do. And he started fighting. He grew up in Philadelphia, I believe in Philadelphia. And his high school was integrated, but of course there was still, you know, discrimination. And one of he was on the football team. And I think they went on a trip and they were supposed to segregate the rooms. And he started protesting that. So he just didn't believe in all of this separation. And it's completely arbitrary. You over there, you over there. Why? For something completely arbitrary. I always say, you know, how before you were born, and this sounds like a weird question, but, you know, did you get a checklist and say, okay, I'd like to be born with, you know, this color skin. I'd like to be born to these sets of parents, and I'll check off that they're educated and that they're going to love me and be kind. And I'm going to check off what patch of land that these people are actually living on. I'll check off this box, you know, how much money they have. I'm going to check off this box, what color I'm going to have, and this, that. No, half the stuff that decides our lives, we have nothing to do with. we've got no choice in the matter. But people, you know, act like, you know, it means something that you need to be here and you need to be over here and we need to be separated. So all that circling back to the fact that this guy wasn't putting up with it even in high school, and it led to him not turning up to the draft board and being imprisoned for that. He was so adamant about this segregation being wrong that he started protesting in prison because he didn't even like the segregation in prison. And it caused so much trouble that he ended up being isolated and put into high security in prison. But that was it. It's like, why are you doing this, people? Wake up. And you're right. No movement can be on its own. A lot of people try and cast any movement that is associated with identity as a niche, special interest thing. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely not. Most people, all we're fighting for is what we should have had at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's not there. These things that happen in the U.S. are guaranteed in the Constitution at the, you know, founding of our country. And still, there are large parts of our society, large groups of our citizens, who still, to this day, do not have equal protection under the law, equal access to voting, even though it's all printed up nicely on paper. And so nobody's trying to get anything extra or special. It's what was there all along that was only given to a few.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's another reason why I'm a big fan of his, just because he was like, it's like, there definitely is, like, it's a village and we're all in this together. We're all equal. We're all on the same level and playing field, because that's just what, as humans, that's how we should be seeing each other. Like, I feel like in the United States, like you said, we are told that we have, everyone's created equal. We are told, like, you know, everything applies to us. And it should be fair, and it's definitely not. I mean, we can see that even what's going on today with, like, if you just look at, like, you know, the protests and Black Lives Matter, and it's just 2020 alone is just a great, I guess, case study on how things are, the injustice that is still plaguing this country. And I think having someone like that, he was just very much adamant about standing up and fighting the good fight for those causes. And I think I love the fact that he was like a conscientious objector. That's something that's actually really big in the Quaker faith. That's something that they really stand behind as like one of their pillars. And he was definitely just a man of, like, he walked, he said what he meant, and he backed it up by his actions. And that's something that is just, I feel like it was needed in such a fight as civil rights and everything like that. And I like that his stance was that, you know, it's about the peaceful protest. It's about everyone rising up. Because I feel like in any kind of movement, at all, you need people that don't necessarily resemble you. Like, I feel like you do need that, because they may have access to things, unfortunately, that you don't. And you need those people to kind of be your comrades in this, because, you know, that's how you do start impacting pillars that you may not have that access to. You may not be able to hit those channels, you know? So you need that kind of support.
Well, that's, I mean, we talk about privilege. That's what it is, you know, some voices are listened to more readily.
Yeah, and unfortunately. It can
be, you know, yeah, we know, men, women in the room, you've had those moments where you've said something and it doesn't land, or it doesn't register. And then all of a sudden the same thing is said.
Right.
By somebody else. And it's like genius. And you're like, wait a minute here. What am I missing?
No, I was going to say, but that's like, that's common, and that's what you expect, which I think is what leads to the divisive, like, no, we don't want them in this movement. But there are those, I mean, there may be the outliers, because I've been in meetings where that has been the majority of what happened when I would bring an idea to the table. But I've also had someone be like, say something, and everybody would co-sign, and be like, yeah, that was what Cynthia said. So I actually, you know, thank her. You know, I've had, but that's the type of like thinking I believe that he was having.
Yeah.
And he was sort of like, you need those people to say, you know, no, this is not right. Or no, it's really their idea. Like they are the ones, you know. And that's, I think, kind of like maybe the way that he was going for. Like he totally probably, I mean, I'm just assuming, I'm speculating because I didn't know the man, unfortunately. But I'm sure, he realized, like, you know, there's a lot of bad apples. There's the Strom Thurmonds. There was, like, you know, there's a lot of people.
Bull Connor.
Yeah, Bull Connor. What is it? The governor in Arkansas. I forget his name.
Was that not him? I'm not.
There's another guy.
Up on that, but not that I want to remember him.
Yeah, but there's another one. So there was those, and I'm sure at the time they were more loud because they could be, but I think it's sort of just like, let's pull from the ones that are still there, but have that do see where we're going and see what we're believing or think that this is fair and right and just under what we stand for as a country.
Well, that's what's happening now. It's we're 12% of the population in this country, African Americans. And it seems outsized, like I said, like we're making a lot of noise. But one, you know, the saying goes, power concedes nothing without a demand. If things could be status quo, everybody's quiet, nothing would change. And, you know, some people would be perfectly fine with that. But the problem is, it's about life and death. It's not about, you know, comfort. It's not about this job or that job. It's about all sorts of things. It is literally about life and death. And it's generational. It's about setting back generations because things are not equal for people. The wealth of African Americans and minority groups is a fraction of that of white people because of all the things that people are standing up against. And so it does need to be everybody because as a lot of people are saying right now, you know, the people that are not suffering under the system are benefiting under the system in ways, big and small, whether they realize it or not. And so that maintains the system. And I always stress this. I just feel like, again, it's not me trying to take something. I don't think it's a minority group trying to take something from somebody else. It is about making this world better for everybody that's in it. If your kid's educated, if your kid has enough to eat, if your kid has, feels safe and secure in their home, it helps everybody. And I've said this many times, I think, that or I'm starting to, about the different places I've lived where you have that disparity, where the basic needs of life are not met. I think that's the basic duty of a government is to provide health, security, education to its citizenry. There's all kinds of ways of doing that. But the countries that don't do that and you have such large disparities are not places, you know, where there are good outcomes. It's just kind of horrible. You don't realize what the stress that everybody is living under and how fragile things are because, you know, some people just don't even have enough to eat. All that to say that a better world for some isn't great. We all need to be pushing towards a better world for all, for all. Like I said, that document doesn't promise it, although it was written for white males
who
own property.
That's basically what I always tell people. They're like, well, that's what America stands for. But I'm like, at that time in America, who were the people they were really talking about?
White males who own property.
And who, that's and it. Like, and then, and usually what was their property? So it's like, you know, what was considered, what was considered part of their things that could be their property. And that shows you kind of like how things were stacking up in the country. But I think if we truly want to sound, say, like, that's what we stand behind and say, like, no, that wasn't necessarily what they mean. It's sort of just like being honest about, like, this is what the forefathers are really probably talking about. That's not what we want to uphold now. So let's talk about how we can really level the playing field, because it does say that. And like, people that are not born in the United States and come here, they're thinking like, oh, this is the place where you can. And I feel like there is an element of that. Yeah, yeah, you can pretty much, there's like a lot of other countries that have a lot of other issues. No place is perfect. You can come here and really make, if you really work hard, you can probably make a name and make a legacy for yourself and your family and stuff like that. But I think a lot of people come here thinking like, oh, it's like this land of like milk and honey or whatever it is. And it's not that. And I think for the people that really do live here and we were raised here for the most part, you really do see like, well, it shouldn't be this complicated. I shouldn't be automatically judged by my skin tone. My parents named me this way for a reason. And it's like, you know, like you shouldn't have to do that. You know, and I think there's the people like the Byron-Rustins of the world, like you need people like that to kind of say, you know, we need to think about it, not just necessarily within the Black community, but we need other people that are not necessarily us to see the same picture and then align with us to push it through, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that they take over, because that's the thing that I don't believe, like it shouldn't be that, but it should be them saying, we support you and what you guys are trying to do. Like, you have our support and our backing.
Right. It's interesting what you said, because I always thought, you know, when you go abroad, that's when I was more certain about what it meant to be American. And I know there is the American dream. You come here and you can be anything you want.
So they say,
That's what they say. But what I really found was it's not really so much that it's totally possible. I think it's more that in a lot of places, it's not even possible to think that you can start off in one spot and end up somewhere else. You know, I always say that you could go to the law school in the U.S. and become a lawyer, and then next week decide you want to be a circus performer, and nobody would blink an eye. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen in a lot of countries. Yeah, you kind of start off where you stay where you start off. If you go to school for certain things, that's what you're supposed to follow. And you're supposed to, there's a certain path that you're supposed to follow, you know, if you've studied stuff. And people wouldn't dream of doing something else. If you're an engineer, you wouldn't think of all of a sudden, you know, I'm going to make soap and be an entrepreneur. That's the dream, I think, that is really real around America. Nobody blinks an eye about people saying, you know, yeah, that I'll go do that. And I think that's the freedom we have. And it's almost mental. The steps to getting there can be hard. And we do have success stories that hold up the dream. But they're not as widespread, I think, as we make out. And we're also very good at promoting
the good,
those few success stories and making it look like it's possible for everybody.
True.
That's how I've come to see it.
I agree with that, actually. I mean, I do think that we're very much a capitalist, consumer led driven, marketing driven society. Mm. And we know, I mean, I'm in advertising, so I see it all the time, but yeah, there's definitely that. And that, like, we always want to say like the overnight, people think it's like an overnight success or it's going to happen instantaneously. And it's like, if it happened for them, it happened for you, but it's like, you don't see the struggle stories. You don't see about the people that had to they couldn't fulfill it, or they had to go back home, or like, you know, there's a lot of other things. I feel like it's a risk. It's a game of risk, which is life. I understand that. I just think you probably are afforded the opportunity to at least try here compared to, like you were saying, like there. Cause I mean, like India in the caste system, like you're born a certain thing. Your family did that. That's what you do. You know, that's, you never think about breaking out of that or leaving that. And it's sort of like, kind of like that brainwashing that can happen in other places. I mean, I think elements of that happen here too, but you know, but I think there's like that possibility. I think a lot of people just see like, oh, well, at least it's different and it seems like it's possible there compared to here. And I think for people that live here, we're like, well, you know.
Well, you're talking about living somewhere, you know, you're in the beacon of that idea, you know. Even like you said, here maybe it's not as prevalent. You get the small farm town kid who wants to break out and go to the big New York City, and you know, make their dreams come true. That is the promise of New York.
True.
And that's why it is a melting pot. It is a draw. And I like us. You're right. I think it's the marketing of it that it makes it look like, oh yeah, and we're living in an age of that where people, you know, especially the contestant mentality, the what do you call it, the game show thing, where people are overnight success because of some competition or
and influencers,
you know, on the internet. It looks like you don't have to do anything to just be, you know, amazing and have this amazing life.
Say, like, the influencer thing still boggles my mind, like how that's a career. Because I was like up and I put, this is a side tangent and I'll make it quick, but I play Sims, and I like, there's people that's what their due is, like their full-time job is them playing and watch people watch them play, and I'm sitting there like, wow.
There's a story in that. But that's the stuff that gets promoted, and then it thinks you're like, oh, I'm just not trying hard enough. But then there are stories in this, especially in the U.S., of student debt. You know how crushing that is.
Yeah,
you're trying to build your dream, but then you're weighed down, and that does it influences all kinds of people in this country, but particularly people of color. So you know, there's all sorts of things. This man basically is still, he fought for things that we're still fighting for now. And it's interesting because some of the big things that we benefited from, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act are because of his genius, basically. And one of the things I really think is important that gets missed out is you often hear the story of Martin Luther King Jr. being nonviolent and taking the nonviolent approach, but really, Bayard Rustin is the one who introduced this concept to him. He was so interested in this idea. He started helping sanitation workers before Martin Luther King Jr. organized. But after Gandhi was assassinated, there was a conference about peace and peaceful ways of organizing. And he went over to India and participated in that conference. And that is information he brought back to Martin Luther King Jr. He went down and approached him and talked to him about this. And that's where some of these ideas got in, because it's often abridged that Martin Luther King Jr. heard about Gandhi. And all of a sudden, you know, that was the approach that he landed on. But really, it came from Bayard Rustin. It was a world pacifist conference in 1948 that he went to in India.
And it's like one of those things, like he gave so much to the civil rights movement and to working with MLK and everything like that. And like, he helped with King. He did like a lot of different things for, was it the Southern Leaders? Is it Southern Leaders Conference?
Yeah, I know. It's SNCC. We have to look up all our acronyms.
I know. I'm horrible with the acronyms.
The Southern Christian Leadership Conference. There's CORE. There's the Urban League, the NAACP, and the Sleeping Car Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. These were the organized groups for African American
and
rights.
He kind of like helped a lot, like shepherd things through, was like very, he was very active, very like vocal in these organizations. And then it kind of became one of those things where, I mean, I love the fact that he was gay and he big on his Quaker faith, and he didn't necessarily toe the line of what you consider like a typical African American man at that time. But of course, like a lot of people thinking, and this is another thing that kind of like bothers me, is like when there's these movements and people feel like there has to be a figurehead and people feels like we have to have a certain image and a certain whatever, like if you don't toe that line of what they think that you should be, they will push you out. And that to me was like kind of like a disservice to the movement, because that's what kind of what happened here with the civil rights movement, with working with MLK. A lot of things happened because I feel like a lot of men, I don't like to say like a lot of men, it's like I'm not generalizing or anything like that, but I think there was a lot of friction, at least I know with Adam Clayton Powell, which is there was a lot of friction there. Pretty much like he was looking at the movement, everything like that, knew Barrett Rustin was gay. And he was like, if things don't change or any shift like that, then I'm going to start basically come out and say that there was something going on between Rustin and King. And
yes.
And it's sort of...
You're dancing around it. He was going to say they were lovers.
Well, he was going to say they were lovers.
He was just going to spread it. He put it out there. He was going to blackmail them.
And then it was sort of... he was going to put out that they were lovers. And it was sort of like this whole big thing. King was like, well, I can't have that happen. And blah, 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 because of the movement. So he pushed out Rustin or Bayard Rustin. He pushed them out. And then... But he lost a lot of like the youth... like the youth supporters because of that, because a lot of people really, the youth at the time took to Barrett Rustin, because a lot of the things, because he was very, like I said, he was very active and vocal. He would go to the rallies, he would speak, there's like a lot, he would speak and do like a lot of these like lectures. He was like out in the thick of it with the people, and a lot of people like just liked his type of energy and vibe and what he was saying, you know. And then there was like that conservative leadership, even though I think they were probably MLK and Rustin were around the same age or whatever, but it, like, I think MLK was definitely more conservative leaning, you know, he was a pastor and all those other type of stuff. And it just really, like, I mean, I feel like something like that bothers me. I feel like, and I know I talked to you about this, like, we should really talk about, like, the civil rights movement from all sides one day.
Yeah.
Just because a lot of people feel like, oh, and not downplaying anything that King did, but they're human. He's human.
Yes.
He was a man of his time. And there's a lot of things like that. Like, what would happen if King was like, you know what? You do what you have to do, Adam.
I know what it is, and
I'm cool with Barrett. I love what he's doing. We're going to stand together and we're going to do this. Like, you know, instead of like bending to the times.
Oh my goodness. And, I know.
And saying like, well, no, we're going to get rid of him and just keep going. Like, imagine like, cause the powerhouse, because they were a powerhouse, because like MLK, like he had that presence. He was an excellent orator. He could like those speeches and stuff, like give you chills and everything like that. But if he had like the backhand was like, or even not like his second command in a way was bare, like you can imagine the stuff they would have done throughout the course of their lives, or at least until, you know, of course, King got assassinated and everything, but up until that point, the stuff they could have done together.
Well, that's it. Also, you know, that's a key point you made. He took the younger followers with him. He broke it up. That broke up the movement. It keeps reminding me of Bernie Sanders, you know.
Yeah.
You need the young people to be involved in this because it's their future. It's, you know, and I think, you know, younger people, thank goodness, seem to be quicker to arrive at some of this stuff than older generations, more conservative generations. And it's their future. It's in their hands. And so to disengage such an important group to all of this is sad, because I think that makes it, you know, two steps backwards for all the progress you get. That's another thing, you know, everybody that's protesting now, and there's people all over, there are people in Belarus protesting, you know, government corruption. There are women in India protesting violence against women. We, in this country, after the Marjorie Stoneman shooting, high school shooting, the young people organized and protested. They all inherited this movement from the civil rights movement. I mean, it started earlier. There was always people protesting. Somebody said, if you were born a slave, you were born a revolutionary. because, you know, you're always fighting for your rights. But the people that are doing this now inherited the way of going about it from Bayard Rustin. And I joked, I said, he's the architect of this, because there are a lot of things around it. It is about, you know, identifying what are you protesting for? What do you want? You got somebody's attention. What do you want? The result of the civil rights movement, again, was the, you know, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. That was very specific. People were fighting for equal access to voting. Black men were given the right to vote, but then everything under the sun was put in the way to stop people from voting, from literacy tests to, you know, all sorts of craziness, which is, so it's not really giving you what is promised. And now I think we've got groups of young people and all sorts of activists that understand the power in numbers and the fact that being organized around an issue and demands can get you somewhere. And I think that's key. If you're going to call attention, you need to be able to ask for something. We had recently in this country, the NBA went on strike after the Breonna Taylor decision, I believe. You can correct me if you know. I think that was,
yeah, they did go, like, it was it had to do with Breonna Taylor, because they were all very much like the, I think the is it Minnesota or Wisconsin?
Breonna Taylor was Kentucky.
No, but I'm saying, like, there was, like, a big, like, the Lakers did something big. I was trying to say the Milwaukee Bucks did something big. I was talking about the NBA teams.
Yes, the teams, yes. So they went, there was a NBA game, I think it was in the playoffs, and they decided they were going to go on strike after the decision about this young woman who was asleep in her bed, an essential worker who was an EMT, and because of a mistake, no-knock warrant, the police busted into her house in the middle of the night, and, you know, her boyfriend tried to defend her, but a shootout took place, and she was killed in her bed while she slept. And, you know, they protested, they used their power, but they didn't just protest, they had demands. And one of them is that any sports venue used for the NBA will be used and converted into a voting place, a polling place, because they are large in scale and will allow for safer voting during the pandemic. And this wouldn't necessarily happen before, that they did it as a protest, but they had a demand at the end. The young people at Marjorie Stoneman High School want gun regulation, and it's the first group that understood their power. They still have years and years and years and years to vote. They now understand what it means to have your local representatives not toe the line, even though it is the opinion of the majority that something should happen. They understood their power. So Bayard Rustin mobilized power to meet certain demands. Unfortunately, we still have a long list.
Yeah, we do.
It's a long, long list.
But I also think there was a thing that he did a lot of that, like, in a nonviolent type of way. You know, I mean.
Yeah, I mean there's a whole thing about that. So the question is, so again, in this time, in this day and age, there's a lot of debate about the violence that is accompanying the current protest. And I think it is a key moment in the civil rights movement was when the National Guard was called out. We mentioned this man, Bull Connor, who was just an a-hole. Yeah. the shorthand for that, who basically, you know, it was the fire hoses. It was the images of the fire hoses being used on peaceful protesters. It is the act of, I'm trying to fight for my rights in a decent human way. I think that was the only way, or it, that people's humanity, it's sick, but their humanity could be seen because they didn't raise arms. It was clear, just like we saw with George Floyd.
That's true.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's, what do you think about that? It's the only way you can be seen as a human being is if you don't raise your arms.
I feel like it's unfortunate, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like it's I was going to swear, but I'm going to censor myself. But I feel like it's messed up because, like, a lot of those pictures and video and stuff you see of the fire hoses and the dogs being sicked on these men and women and children, and, like, they are just doing, like, things that we should be able to do, like sitting at a restaurant. We should be able to do that.
Oh, my gosh.
And then you have all these pictures of them sitting there trying to eat with a stone face straight ahead because I'm sure they want to just, like, cry and just, like, do all these things on the inside. And there's, like, all these people behind them, like, yelling and pointing with so much, like, anger. And you're just like, really? You know, so it's like that juxtaposition. And I feel like then it's like it's almost unfair, which I feel like that's another issue with the how people view race and everything in this country. And as soon as you try to defend yourself, they're going to be like, well, you know, they caused this. Like, if it wasn't for the fact that you were doing this, and you're not supposed to do this, I wouldn't have to react the way that you did. And then you combat it and try to protect yourself. But you're all in the wrong, because if you weren't here in the first place, this none of this would have happened.
You provoked me.
You provoked me to do this.
A cup of coffee.
Which is BS. Which is BS the entire way. But that's just like how they kind of spin it. And I feel like I wouldn't say like I'm necessarily 100% like, you know, it needs to be nonviolent. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say that. But I think that now it's getting like people are playing that card and now saying like the conservatives are the peaceful protesters. And I'm like, are you guys kidding me? Like, are you guys truly like kidding me? Because if you really look at the makeup of what's happening, it's not just necessarily like, it's like they're making it like a black versus white thing and saying like, whether they want to come out and say that or not. And it's saying like, you know, and I feel like when you say black and you say like the Black Lives Matter, the people are the protesters and they're aggressive and they're angry, then they're basically saying like, to me, it sounds like you're still saying like, well, black people are savages. They can't do anything without being savage.
There's an element of that. I think that's very, very, well, you don't deserve this because look at how you behave kind of thing.
But it's like who's, but my whole thing, I know we talked about it, but it's like, who's really doing like all this damage and all on all the, and come on, like those, I could go on and on and rant and be so angry about this.
Because, well, this is what this venue's for.
Oh, it's true, but it drives me crazy because they're saying like, okay, all of a sudden like the other side is peaceful protest, but they're not. If you're on the phone with somebody, like if you have a megaphone in someone's face, you're not being a peaceful protester. If you're yelling at them and trying to incite them, they're you're not being a peaceful protester. Like, that's not peaceful at all. It's like, if you think about peaceful as people doing what they had to do, and they just did what they had to do. Like I said, when I think about peaceful protests, it is the boycotts. It's the people, it's the sit-ins.
It's the sit-ins. It's
Lions. They've had lions. Lions. It's like a lot of the stuff that he did, like people like would do, like even like when it was for like the war, they would hold hands or do something to like block certain stuff like that. It's like, you know, that's when I'm thinking about peaceful protesting. I feel like if you're yelling, if you're in a mob or whatever you want to say, and you're trying to get
if
a reaction.
You show up with a machine gun on your back.
Right. You're trying to incite a reaction. So that to me, or provoke somebody, that's not a peaceful protest. You yelling and antagonizing somebody, that's not a peaceful protester. And it's like, it's not. It's like, it's, and I don't care what how you want to spin it, saying like us versus them, peaceful protesters versus like these savages over here, because that's basically what I think you're saying, whether you want to come out and say that or not, because of being PC and all. It's you're doing the same thing. It's like opposite sides of the same freaking coin. And it's like, no, there's nothing coming from that, because it's like you're just trying to keep the pot going instead of just saying like, what are these people, what like these protests happen for a reason. Let's look at the cop brutality. Let's really understand that. Let's see where it's coming from. And it's like doing that deductive reasoning. I feel like people just can't do that anymore. Like,
it feels like,
the cognitive dissonance to me is like mind blowing.
Yeah. It's it's more than frustrating. It's aggravating. And like I said, this is stuff that people have been fighting over. I mean, this goes way back, the early 1900s. It feels like it's new, but we're fighting the same battles over and over again, because some people just don't get it. And again, I think it's always, like you said, it's framed as me against you. If I get something, you lose something. And it's not. No interest in that.
I agree with you. It's like, it's a human issue. And that's what I say. Like, I like that you mentioned, like, a lot of people, like, a lot of younger people are thinking about local. Because I feel like, yes, a lot of times, like, we kind of, and I like that a lot of the younger generation is focusing on local. Because so much of what we are talking about and what, like, Bayard Rustin and all those people were fighting for is, like, yes, in the White House, you know, however you stand and whatever your stance is on that, it is what it is, you know. But, yeah, and people focus on that. But it's like, you need to think about your people that are local to you and where you are and influencing that, because your voice and what you do matters there, because those people are the ones that you're putting in power to advocate for you. So you, yeah, need to know what they stand for. You need to know if you can get in bed or you can get behind them. And that's the stuff that you really need to focus on. I mean, that's stuff, like, I learned that late, you know. I focused on, like, the VP, the president, you know, all that type of stuff. But it's like, but now I'm like, I'm all about, like, okay, what's happening in Kings County, you, yeah, know, and, yeah, and who are the, my representatives, who are, like the judges. It's like, I look at, yeah, all that stuff.
Well, that's the thing. I think, I mean, this is very important. We are in the United States coming up to a major presidential election. Both sides say, you know, this is the election of a lifetime.
It really is, though.
There's a real disconnect between, you know, there's a lot of ambivalence in this country. We have a very poor voter turnout, because I think people don't understand that all these people, the people that you just mentioned, they are making decisions that affect your life and the lives of people you care about. And I keep saying that anybody who doesn't have to care whether a baby gets separated from their mother, or doesn't have to care about whether you get COVID and get sick and end up with a disability if you survive, or anybody who doesn't have to worry about the police, you know, treating a traffic stop as something more and becoming violent, then you're lucky. You're a lucky person, I would say, because a lot of citizens have to worry about these things. And so if you're just voting without thinking about all sorts of considerations about your fellow citizens, I think that's, you know, it's really short-sighted.
It is.
It's creating a society that's not even good for you. And so I think people, that figurehead, the presidency and the vice president, they are the head, but they come with thousands of people that influence our lives, make decisions, yes, about the safety of our food, the cost of our medicine, the interest rates on your student loans. So it matters, and it's a simple thing to do. People died for you to be able to go and voice, just have a voice. And you might think your one little vote doesn't mean anything, it doesn't matter, but it's the cumulative effect. You're a voting block, and we're 300 plus million people in the United States. How can we all want exactly the same thing? No one human being is going to satisfy 300 plus million people. So at least think about who will move things in a better direction for the majority of people, and hopefully all people, but at least the majority. You don't need to have your perfect issue or perfect person. That person does not exist, but they bring lots of people with them. And further down, as you've said, Cynthia, that person might exist, particularly if you get involved, then they really do exist. So That was my little pitch for the importance of voting and all that went. And I'm tired of fighting these fights over and over. I mean, I think people must be rolling in their graves going, they're doing this again.
They're still doing this.
But I feel like that's another thing. Like, I feel like as Americans, we're so like individual, like it's very individualistic, you know? And it's like, I get that, you know, I mean, I don't get that. I would say like, I get that, but it's like, I understand that that's kind of like how Americans get down. Not all, yeah. But like, that's kind of like a thing. And it's like, we really need to start thinking about me and just saying like, we, like what works best for all of us. Because it's like, and that's why I say like local, look local, because you guys can be totally on two different sides of the fence when it comes to like, you could be a Democrat, conservative, Republican, independent, whatever. But it's sort of like, if you look at this thing, like, is this person the best to really help us as like a society or as a group of people within where we all live? Because it's like, we all are going to be impacted by this person, and it will, yeah. will we be impacted the right way? You know, because I feel like a lot of people just get so like bogged down on like party lines and like, and then this is what I stand for, and like not, and I feel like I said, a lot of it goes down to me is like deductive reasoning and sort of like, does their platform make sense? Do you agree with their stance on everything or most things? You know, do you know what they're about? You know, can you speak to that?
Right.
Instead of saying like, they're a Democrat or they're a Republican. Or Trump's not a politician, so I trust. And I'm like, oh, anyway, you can tell where my without saying. Yeah,
I emphasize that you're not going to find the perfect person. No. Government is a, I think government is a system of experiments. In aid of trying to do those things I mentioned before, give people security, health, and education. And we've seen it because there's so many different forms of the same, you know, under the same umbrella of democracy. You've got representative democracy and constitute, you know, all these different variations. You've got socialist countries, and, you know, half the people in this country don't know what socialism means. You know, we've got all these different ways of going about it. They are experiments, people. It wasn't written in a book that this government on this piece of land is going to work. And so the fact that you just hold true to that checklist of things that you care about, and if they don't line up exactly, it's all goes out the window, it's not worth it. It means there's no progress anywhere. And it also means you're dismissing your own power in this. Mm-hmm. You have power, even if it's a small amount. Again, looking at the local things, educating yourself, getting involved yourself, running for office, whatever it might be. I think that's the key to the people we highlight. They realize their power in all of this, and weren't certain of the outcome. You know, this man worked with groups that, like you said, they outright could have rejected him. But he understood that they needed to be part of the story to be able to bring about what you were trying to achieve.
It was not the greater good, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I'm sure he wasn't happy with everything. And they certainly weren't happy with everything with him. But in order to get anywhere, to a better place, and that better place is the life I've lived, I have to say. I have benefited from everything that was done. Mm-hmm. That was the greater good. It wasn't good. It wasn't totally good. It wasn't good enough because we're still, like I said, fighting for all sorts of things. But it moved us in a better direction. And so that has to be good enough for the moment until we take the next step. So I long roundabout way of saying that it doesn't have to be perfect to get some forward momentum that's positive.
True story. Sherry, true story. But yeah, so, Bear Rustin, he was awesome. If you're interested in learning more, there's a you kind of have to search for it a little bit, but there's information about him out there. There's biographies. With a couple of authors, there's Jervis Anderson, Daniel Levine, John D'Amelio, and Gerald Poldar. So feel free to check those out. His collection of writings. There's a collection of his writings out there as well. He was also posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And his long-term partner, Walter Nagel, actually received it in his honor. He's a Hall of Honor inductee by the Department of Labor because he did a lot of work there as well. The Bayer Rustin LGBT Coalition was founded in San Francisco, and he was also inducted to the Legacy Walk, which is part of the Castro neighborhood in San Francisco, which is a bigger part of their Rainbow Walk of Fame, which I'm sad I didn't see when I was out there. So I'm going to have to go.
Yeah. See, you missed out.
I know. I have to go out there and look. I know. I'm going to have to go back and do that as well when I go back to California one of those days. But there's so much out there about him. I hope you really enjoyed this episode. Please go out there and vote. Please, 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 please. It's coming up before we know it. It's crazy.
Your vote is your voice, and you've got more power and say in what happens to you than you think you do. Till next time, go out and do it. Be who you want to be in this world. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.